Welcome to Issues and Ideas. I'm your host for today, Brian Lanzone. On today's program, enjoy a visit to San Luis Obispo's Granada Hotel for some fun at their art bar, where patrons learn to paint while sipping on wine. Leslie Westbrook chats with one of the teachers at the art bar and channels her own inner artist at a recent class. Also, Chrissy Hewitt continues her conversation with award-winning metalsmith Gary Griffin for another edition of Ears on Art. But up first, let's hear a conversation about John Steinbeck's life in the Salinas Valley with correspondent Tom Wilmer as he visits the Steinbeck Center. Then head with Tom over to Elkhorn Slough to learn about its birds and sea life and to discover the kayaking and whale watching opportunities in the area.
John Steinbeck, poet laureate and Pulitzer Prize-winning author, was born in Salinas, California back in 1902. His childhood home still stands. His high school, Salinas High, is just a couple blocks away, as is the Catholic church where he was an altar boy. Most of the scenes and settings in and around Salinas and throughout the valley remain remarkably unchanged from the time when he penned East of Eden back in 1952. John Steinbeck was the author who most profoundly affected and influenced me as a writer, and thus it was akin to a journey to Mecca to visit the National Steinbeck Center in the heart of downtown Salinas, California. I'm Tom Wilmer. Come along and join me for a conversation about John Steinbeck's life in the Salinas Valley with Colleen Finnegan Bailey, the executive director at the National Steinbeck Center, presently celebrating the 75th anniversary of the book Grapes of Wrath.
This land was made for you and me.
This is a great place to come. I think somebody could come here probably 20 times and not get it all.
Well, I've been working here for about 5 years, and I learn something new just about every day.
Tell us about what are you most proud of?
I think I am most proud of the fact that, especially in the last few years, we have really found new ways to make Steinbeck relevant to communities who don't necessarily know his work. We have changing exhibitions. We have over 64 programs each year, which really bring, I think, Steinbeck's themes out, which are very relevant to today's audience. I think entice people to go back and reread or to read for the first time Steinbeck's great work.
My favorite aspects of Steinbeck and the Steinbeck Center is you are right dead center in the heart of where he grew up, the streets he walked. Right up the street, there's Salinas High School he graduated from, and the church where he was an altar boy. You literally can walk in the footsteps of John Steinbeck.
Right, and there are walking tours that you can take from the Steinbeck Center where you can visit some of the locales from his books. So you can see where Kate stopped by the store, the bank that Kate visited, and so on in the downtown area. Not only can you kind of feel John Steinbeck, but you can feel the characters and some of the stories that John Steinbeck's most famous for.
Short drive out of town, the farm and ranching land, drive by some of the farmhouses, and it's palpably Steinbeck description and destination.
You know, Salinas really hasn't changed all that much. The historic downtown still has a lot of the character that John Steinbeck would have known in his day, and the land, the agriculture land, is, as you say, so beautiful, and you see the Gabilan and the Santa Lucia Mountains that are beautiful in any time of year, and if you read the first chapter of East of Eden, his description of this valley, you can see that just like it was written for today. Mm-hmm. It's really a beautiful description of the valley.
Or like the chrysanthemum, I think it is, a mm-hmm. short story. Mm-hmm. I know that farmhouse.
No, exactly. And a lot of those farmhouses are still here. There is an area of town out in the Corral de Tierra area that has Castle Rock, which mm-hmm. is a rock structure that still exists out there and that John Steinbeck called the Pastures of Heaven. We, in fact, this last year did some programs out there where people could go out and see some actors perform and have a barbecue dinner right under Castle Rock in this beautiful valley that looks just exactly like John Steinbeck described in The Pastures of Heaven.
And out in Corral de Tierra, I understand that when he was a kid, he would spend time out there with a relative.
He would spend time out there. They would take horses, his family, and he would travel from Salinas over to the coast. They had a little home in Pacific Grove. That was their seashore home. They would take their horses out and they would ride in the Corral de Tierra area and he would look up at those castle rocks, and he would imagine himself to be King Arthur. Mm-hmm. And his little sister Mary would ride on the horse with him, and they would play act out there. He was very inspired by the story of King Arthur, even as a child. And later on in his life, he actually lived in Bruton, England for a couple of years, studying the actual history of King Arthur, and then wrote his own version of the King Arthur story. It was published posthumously.
How old was he when he lived in England?
I think it was in his early 60s. Mm-hmm. So he was married to his last wife, Elaine, in those days. People who he knew are still alive there. So during our Steinbeck Festival, which happens in the first weekend of May every year, we oftentimes do kind of a Skype program with the Bruton people. The home that he lived in there has never been changed. So you can see images of that home, which was a historic old home, even in the time that John Steinbeck lived there.
And even right here in the Salinas Valley, there are people who remember.
There are not many of them mm-hmm. left, but there are still a few in their 80s and 90s who remember him. And certainly just about everybody who has lived here for generations has heard stories about John Steinbeck. So we have a woman who's very, very close to the center whose mother went to high school with John Steinbeck, and she tells stories about, you know, having to dance with John, her, you know, that her mother insisted that she dance with John at the high school dance and so on. So lots of stories here and people's, you know, who have lots of memories of John Steinbeck's time here in Salinas.
Going back in time during the Depression era, his writings were not very popular with some of the local people here in Salinas Valley.
That is true. He was very critical of people, and he, of course, used the local people as inspiration for many of the characters of his books, and in some cases, he did not have flattering portrayals of people, and people in the community recognized who he might have pulled from in terms of inspiring those characters. So he was known as being a rascal as a young person, and then was made even less popular by many of his works. But at the same time, there was a local librarian who collected everything that he wrote. And it's one of the reasons that we have the wonderful archive that we have here at the National Steinbeck Center. A lot of it comes from this one person's collection, because he could tell from the very beginning that John Steinbeck had a lot of talent and maybe a famous writer one day. And of course he was.
That's interesting. Let's talk about some of the archival stuff that you have here that is breathes life into Steinbeck.
Well, I guess our most treasured piece is something you can see in the museum itself, and that is the camper that John Steinbeck traveled the country with to write Travels with Charlie. The camper is called Rosinante. It is one of the last things you see when you go through our Steinbeck exhibition hall.
And that's the real one.
That is the real Rosinante, and in fact, when you look into the back, it's decorated to look quite homey, and his wife Elaine made the curtains that still hang there. She wanted it to feel like a home away from home, and so you see those original curtains and so on, and it looks like a really cozy little place to travel around in. One of the other things that, if you're interested in hearing oral histories, we have one of the largest collections of recordings of people who knew Steinbeck. And so there was a woman, a local woman, who went and interviewed all kinds of people who worked in brothels, people who worked in agriculture, people who worked in business, people who would have been neighbors of the Steinbeck family. And we have all those recordings, which have recently been digitized, and they're all part of our archive. So you can come and hear from the people who knew John Steinbeck what he was actually like and what this town was like back when he was writing about it.
Very cool.
Of course, we have lots of first editions. We have some of the furniture and the items, the personal items that John Steinbeck had in the house that he lived in New York City. So the chair that he wrote in, his eyeglasses, his pipes that he smoked, his wallet, all his little personal items that he kept, we have all of those, so you can come and get a sense of what his life was like in those last days. We also have, this is a recent item. I had the pleasure last spring of going back and meeting with Elaine Steinbeck's sister, Jean Boone, who was Elaine's younger sister and who lived lived with John Steinbeck and Elaine when they lived in New York, and spent a lot of time in Sag Harbor in their home. And she still owns the property on Sag Harbor. And so she allowed me to videotape her.
Still sharp.
Oh, she's very sharp. But she's got a wonderful personality and has wonderful stories to tell. So we have a digital recording of her interview, which is about 2 hours long. We have some items that she gave to us on that trip from the collection that she saved over these many years. It was interesting to be in that house because his writing room that was right out on the waterfront there in the Sag Harbor property was still completely restored. It looked just as if John Steinbeck was going to walk in and begin writing any day. So we got to go in there and take images of those, and we have all of those images.
Right down the street, there's a Steinbeck home. Tell us about that.
Right. John Steinbeck's home is about two blocks from the National Steinbeck Center, and it has been completely restored to look just as it did when John Steinbeck lived there.
And he was a young child then? That's where he... High school?
Yeah, he was born and raised there, and actually his family lived there after he moved away, and he came back when his mother was very sick and took care of her, and she was still living in that home. So it's been completely restored. It's actually run by another nonprofit organization, and you can go and visit it. They run it as a restaurant now, and they have tea that they serve there, and they have lots of special events, and you can go and you can see family photos still on the wall and enjoy John Steinbeck's favorite drink and a wonderful meal and learn more about John Steinbeck and his history here in the Salinas Valley.
That's great. Colleen Finnegan-Bailey, thank you for sharing. This has been a wonderful day for me.
Thank you so much for visiting us.
For further information, website?
Steinbeck.org.
Oh, that's easy. Thank you so much.
Then I was strolling, the wheat fields waving, the dust clouds rolling, the voice coming chanting, fog was lifting. This land was made for you and me.
While staying in Salinas, California, I headed north out of downtown and within 15 minutes arrived at Elkhorn Slough at Moss Landing. Elkhorn Slough is one of the premier locations to savor marine wildlife in view, one of the greatest diversities of bird species spotted on the West Coast. I'm Tom Wilmer. Come along and join me for a visit with Sean Fury, Monterey Bay Kayaks at Elkhorn Slough.
From town, she watches seagulls fly, silver on the ocean, stitching through the waves.
What a great place to kayak and bird watch and everything right behind us in the Elkhorn Slough.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a unique environment. No place quite like it in the California coast.
This really is a real popular kayaking destination, isn't it?
Yeah, it's great because you're in a marine environment and you've got all sorts of marine life, the seals, the sea otters, the sea lions, but it's a lot more protected than the open coast, so you can come to a much calmer place, a much easier access place than somewhere, you know, along the open coast.
We just spent the morning kayaking in the slough, and we saw a lot of wonderful, touching wildlife, and of course, everybody's favorite are the sea otters. That's their little haven, isn't it?
There's really intense concentration of sea otters here. It's so protected that they feel comfortable. There's a lot of food for them throughout the day. You can see them feeding, breaking open clams with rocks, using tools. During certain times of the year, you've got mothers with pups. You know, all year round, we have a pretty good-sized population. Actually, some research being done that otters will come from other places, and, you know, older otters will take rest here and stay here for a while before moving on.
Truly a safe harbor. We cruised within feet of 1,000 pelicans that were just hanging out back there. Why do they congregate there?
It's a calm area, and we do have a lot of food here, so we do have a year-round population. But at the moment, we've got a lot of pelicans. This is right in sort of the migratory bird channel, and so we've got a lot of pelicans coming from farther north, going down to Baja, California.
Talk to us about birding. This is a premier place of the entire West Coast of the United States.
Yeah, bird watching here is absolutely amazing. You've got a wide variety of birds. During a low tide, you've got a very intense amount of shorebirds combing through the mud, picking up invertebrates, feeding that way. You've also got a lot of the little diving birds, different types of grebes, diving ducks like mergansers, terns, dive bombing, several different species of terns. You've got different duck species throughout the year. Because the slough's so big, you can start out in one area, see one type of bird, and then farther back, you're going to see very different types of feeding behaviors and birds.
Let's talk kayaking in particular for a moment. You have hourly rentals. Do you also have guided tours?
Yeah, we also do guided tours as well as classes. We've got a variety of tours, anything from riding the tide, seeing the whole slough, to doing full moon tours.
Tell us about the attraction of the full moon tour. What's cool about that?
Being out at night is such a different experience, just the calmness and the stillness. But even when the moon isn't out, I've had foggy days where you get this intense bioluminescence, flash of light, so every paddle stroke will swirl with light, and the bow of your kayak will be lit up.
Floating in space, in a way.
It's a lot like that, especially when it gets really foggy and it just sort of muffles everything around you. And because it's such a calm, nice environment, it's easy to do the self-guided tours.
The majority of the people that go out kayaking, they predominantly go on in the tandem kayaks?
Yeah, it's a great way to get out there. You've got twice the horsepower, and then they tend to be stabler boats.
What are your things that you're most proud of that you love talking about or sharing about right here, Elkhorn Slough and this adventure?
It's just so different throughout the year. You get so many great things. I love watching unique interactions between animals. I've seen, during weird low tides, I saw a harbor seal, young harbor seal pup chasing after a bat ray. I love it when we get interesting deep water species coming in. And you get to see all sorts of jellyfish and sunfish and just a variety of things you can see in this one small place.
So you never know what you're going to get.
Exactly.
Sean Fury, what a pleasure talking with you, and especially kayaking all morning. That was awesome. I loved it.
We couldn't have asked for better weather or more interesting animals.
We've been speaking with Sean Fury at Monterey Bay Kayaks at the Elkhorn Slough right near Moss Landing. Moss Landing is located just a few hundred yards from Elkhorn Slough on the Monterey Bay, and that's where I boarded a Sanctuary Cruises Whale Watch boat for a morning pursuit of the humpback whale. It's kind of like going to Vegas. You never know if you're going to have any luck or not. But the morning we went out, within minutes, we encountered a pod of humpback whales breaching and flipping their flukes. I'm Tom Wilmer. Come along and join me as we visit with marine biologist and fourth-year student at UC Santa Cruz, Giancarlo Tomei.
So a lot of you guys on the right side of the boat are looking at the California sea otters.
Giancarlo, here we are on a whale-watching boat.
Right now, we are coming back in the port of Moss Landing, California, after a very successful whale-watching trip in the Monterey Bay.
Tell us about what is special in your mind, your heart, about what you do.
First of all, no day is ever the same. It's always changing. I really love it when I see the look on a kid's face when they see a whale for the first time, or the excitement in everybody's eyes, and hear everybody cheering when they see a whale breach or fly out of the water or doing their unique behaviors.
It's amazing. Literally up close and personal.
We just had four humpbacks come right up the boat today, about 5 feet away, and just look at us, and we're looking in their eyes, and that's truly a life-changing experience.
What do you think they think?
They're highly intelligent animals, and they are very curious. I've seen many of the same whales exhibit their friendly behaviors over the years. I think they really just like to see us out there, and you see our excitement, and they like to check us out from time to time.
Now let's join Captain Corey Edgel in the wheelhouse.
Right now, it looks like we've come up across a couple of humpback whales. They're probably feeding on anchovies, and they surface every few minutes, and then they take a dive and go down and school up the anchovies and come up and feed. We can get, within 200 feet of them, but we're not allowed to impede their traffic. So basically, you just don't cut them off, and everybody's happy.
Do you luck out and get to watch them breaching once in a while?
Oh, yeah, we get to see them breach quite often. Nobody knows why they breach, but there's a lot of theories. Communication, maybe there's a parasite on them. But, yeah, they'll definitely breach, pretty much day to day. You get to see them.
They're hanging out here
because they're fueling up?
They come to the Monterey Bay to feed in the summer months, and then they'll head down to down south to the Costa Rica, the warmer waters, to breed. And that's where they have their calves. And then they once the calves have enough weight on them, blubber, they can bring them up to the cooler waters.
For further information,
check out our website, which is sanctuarycruises.com.
Giancarlo, thank you.
You're welcome.
This is Issues and Ideas on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. Still to come on today's program, Chrissy Hewitt continues her conversation with award-winning metalsmith Gary Griffin for another edition of Ears on Art. But up next, Leslie Westbrook visits San Luis Obispo's Granada Hotel for some fun at their art bar.
All right, guys. Everybody ready to move on? Yay, all right. And now does everybody have a drink?
Yeah.
Yay! Cheers! Cheers! Salute! Salute! Salute!
That's Brianna Devereaux. She's an artist based in Arroyo Grande that's leading a class of about a dozen participants at the Granada Hotel's Art Bar in downtown San Luis Obispo. What's an art bar, you may ask? It's the venue for painting classes that are open to the public as well as hotel guests. For $40, you get a canvas, the use of paintbrushes, easels, and paint, 2 hours of instruction, and a glass of wine. I'm Leslie Westbrook, and I decided to channel my inner artist recently at the Granada Hotel's really cool art bar. Our teacher, Brianna Devereaux.
I do a lot of still life in my own work, but usually when I'm doing still life, I kind of, I abstract it a little bit. I add lines where lines don't go, or I extend lines, or I add color where color isn't. Tonight I'm simplifying that a little bit. We're painting from life, so I'm showing people how to paint an image.
Our teacher has set up a still life, a typical still life, a wine bottle, a bowl of fruit, and a vase of flowers. So the question is, what colors are we going to choose? How are we going to paint it? Is it going to be flat, given shape? Anyway, there's a lot to contemplate.
Okay, so has everybody decided what they're going to do? Yeah? Cool. Now we're going to start painting. Just kind of get an idea of what you want the painting to look like. And that way you can figure out your general composition. Painting is just, it's one decision after another. You're just making a decision. I decided to use red.
So, just get an idea of what you want the painting to look like. Painting is one decision after another. We only get one color at a time. Red, super bright lime, green, pink, orange, purple, brown, and yellow. I've been an art major in college and a studio assistant to a number of contemporary LA artists, but decided to become a writer instead. This gave me a chance to dust off my drawing chops. I decided to use the really strong colors, fauvist colors, a bright red background, purple and green wine bottles, yellow lemons in a bright orange bowl, and a green window, the one that looked out to the street. I put a girl in the painting. Her face was green, and so was her body. She sat in a brown chair with yellow polka dots, and she had a big, full pink skirt that filled up a portion of the painting. And in homage to Matisse, I suppose, I painted some bright orange flowers at the bottom of my painting. Art bar teacher Brianna Devereaux tells us not to worry about mistakes.
And if you put something down that you don't like, you have some paper towels next to you. If you notice it quickly and you automatically don't like it, just take a little bit of the paper towel, dip it in your water, and you can just rub that paint off. If the paint's been sitting there for a while and it's dried, you can just paint over it. So let's imagine that our light source is this. So our light is coming from over here. That means all of your highlights are going to be on this side, all of your shadows are going to be on this side. But basically what I want to do is I just want to lay in the shapes of everything that I'm going to paint, everything that I'm going to put down. And I'll give you a little while to do this. If you get ahead of the group, don't keep painting just to keep painting. A lot of times people do that towards the end of the night and they end up wishing they hadn't.
But I was finished. So I walked around the brightly lit room and introduced myself to the other budding artists. We were all women. There was a mother with her two daughters and a number of others having a fun girlfriend's night out. People from on the street who could see us at work through the front windows wandered in to see what was going on, and a couple of enthusiastic and interested fellows told us they were going to try the art bar. I walked around to look at how the other students were doing. Each painting was distinctly different, although many were very cubist in feeling, reminding me of Braque or Picasso. Lindsay Wilkes, a former school teacher and artist, was one of the participants.
My girlfriend Betsy and I just like to get out and do art together. Since we both enjoy teaching art, it's fun for us to explore ourselves and learn more.
Our group was super supportive, especially after one or two glasses of wine, thanks to Sheridan, who circles around the large table providing dollops of paint as well as wine refills.
She said wink if you want more wine. Okay, winking.
Winking, and you have the Merlot.
I did.
Participants tend to be very self-critical. Lindsay Wilkes.
You know, I'm not an acrylic person. I enjoy watercolor, and so acrylic is a stretch for me. So a still life, I don't really enjoy doing a still life. It's too contrived. At least my application of it becomes too contrived.
Whether you live in the area or decide to travel to Slow Town, I suggest you bed down for the night at the Boutique Granada Hotel with its stylish decor and 17 cozy rooms. At the very least, plan on dining in the bistro. We had a delightful dinner pre-art bar on the outdoor patio. And after finishing our masterpieces, a few of us adjourned to the bar for a nightcap and a killer hot peach cobbler fresh from the oven. The best part? You get to take home a finished work of art to show off to your friends and family, along with some newly acquired skills. And who knows? You may have untapped your very own wellspring of talent that you didn't know you had. I posted my painting on Facebook. I got 18 likes and 14 comments, ranging from very Matissean and a natural fauvist from a couple of artists I know and admire to "It looks like me when I was drinking," from a relative who even offered to buy it. Perhaps she was still drinking. The next day, two other hotel guests who participated in the art bar and I decided to take the hotel's complimentary bicycles out for a spin. We rode through town on the bike path, laughing along the way. The scenery was lovely, and I thought I might even try some plein air painting in the future. But I was even more inspired on the Amtrak train ride home to Carpinteria. As I gazed out the window at the landscape, I took in the views of emerald green fields being tilled beneath a brilliant blue sky, cool industrial buildings and shipping containers, field workers' cars parked in a dusty strip of land, and graffitied train cars giving way eventually to the Pacific Ocean and California coastline as we crossed through Hollister Ranch. So, I thought to myself, I am really seeing things with fresh eyes. And isn't that what learning to make art is all about? Yes, I dabbled in paint on canvas, but what I'd really learned was to appreciate the view that is right in front of you, whether you can paint it or not. Special thanks to audio engineer Jeremy Gaylor. I'm Leslie Westbrook for Issues and Ideas.
To see Leslie Westbrook's art bar painting and a video of her experience, like us on Facebook at KCBX FM and check out our page. This is Issues and Ideas on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. Support for KCBX comes from the Basin Street Regulars, presenting the South Burgundy Street Band and the Mudskippers jamming with the Basin Street Regulars on November 24th at 11 a.m. in the Pismo Beach Vets Hall. More information is at pismojazz.com. Coming up at 2 o'clock here on KCBX, it's On Being with Krista Tippett. What if we understand death as a developmental stage, like adolescence or midlife? Dr. Ira Byock is a leading figure in palliative care and hospice in the United States. He says that if we forget that death is always a personal and human event and not just a medical one, we lose sight of the remarkable value of the time of life we call dying. He shares how we can understand dying as a time of learning, repair, and completion of our lives. That's on today's episode of On Being at 2 o'clock here on KCBX. Up next on Issues and Ideas, Chrissy Hewitt continues her conversation with award-winning metalsmith Gary Griffin. Ears on Art is sponsored by Marshall's Jewelers, creating and selling fine jewelry since 1889. You can visit them on the corner of Hygera and Garden Streets in downtown San Luis Obispo.
The passage of time as an element of sculpture. Impermanence as a medium. Stay tuned. I am Stephen DeLuque, and you are listening to a segment of Issues and Ideas titled Ears on Art, which is dedicated to the exploration and the advancement of the visual arts, produced at the studios of listener-supported public radio station KCBX, which serves Southern Monterey, San Luis Obispo, and Santa Barbara counties on California's idyllic Central Coast. Today, co-host Krissa Hewitt continues her conversation with Gary Griffin, the recipient of the 2013 Lifetime Achievement Award presented by the Society of North American Goldsmiths, also known as SNAG. Krissa interviewed Gary in Toronto, where he was presented the award. Mr. Griffin taught at the School for American Craftsmen at Rochester Institute of Technology from 1974 to 1984. He then went to Cranbrook Academy of Art in Bloomfield Hills, Michigan, where he was artist-in-residence and head of the metalsmithing department. Gary Griffin is also the recipient of two National Endowment for the Arts grants, and his work has exhibited extensively throughout the world. Now, to Krissa Hewitt and Gary Griffin.
If we go back to the formative ways in which your artistic expression developed over the years, the welding was not about artistic, it was about function. But then you were into the metalsmithing field and, you know, the art classes. You started at a jewelry scale in terms of metal.
Okay, now I also had built furniture and I'd actually built a boat, a small sailboat. Then I'd taken machine shop classes, but I had built very small things, nothing substantial, you know, brackets and just simple things. The metalsmithing really took me into making and designing in metal. And so the jewelry was the first step. We began with what was called jewelry, but initially we learned to pierce and use a saw frame and a drill, made a very small flat project and learned to use burnishers and, you know, basic hand tools. And then started moving on into other technical abilities and slowly evolved. But then the second class was the silversmithing class, and that's where we learned to raise. And so I would say that was really the beginning of form. We had to make a can, literally, with a friction-fitted lid. And
remember it well.
And then raise a cup.
Raising is a very old process of hammering a flat sheet, usually a disc, into a seamless vessel.
And also the scale went up. We were soldering with larger torches. We were using natural gas as opposed to propane. We were developing our skill sets and learning about different materials, different tools, different gases. And at that point, we were very fortunate in the sense that you could buy sterling silver for less than $2 an ounce. However, gold at that point was controlled by the government,
right.
And it was set at $40 an ounce. It didn't float in the market. If you got enough students together, I think there was something called a 5-ounce price. If we could get 5 ounces, we could get it down to where 14-karat gold was $20 an ounce. And if you got a quarter ounce, you're talking $5. Well, a beer in a bar was 90 cents. You know, so it was possible. 4 beers and you get a quarter ounce of gold. What do you want? You know? It was approachable and we could do it and we could have experiences in that metal. We were also really fortunate in this program that I was in to have instructors that had different skill sets. One of our instructors was from Germany, and he had been a blacksmith before he became a silversmith. So he said, well, we should have some forges out here. And we did. We made these gas forges during the summer. And, of course, I could weld anything. I made a lot of those.
Guess who was elected, right?
Yes, exactly. It was a very vibrant time. And nothing quite like being a part of a group. It doesn't have to be a large group where there's energy, because you get everybody moving and everybody gets each other moving, and there's a lot of inquisitiveness and really insatiable desire. It's just really good fortune when you can get in a group like that, and I've been lucky.
You finished your graduate degree, and then what?
I graduated from Tyler School of Art in 1974, and during my final year, I started applying for teaching jobs. I applied to schools across the United States. I would go any place to do this work. RIT, the School for American Craftsmen at Rochester Institute of Technology, had an opening. I applied and was hired, which was a great place for me to go because it was an institute of technology. It was a professional craft school. The students did 4 years of metalwork along with whatever academics they had, but they were in the studio 3 days a week. And so it was a very rigorous program of silversmithing and jewelry. I attended to the jewelry, and Hans Christensen was the silversmith. And then at a later date, I was able to bring blacksmithing in, and so we had a blacksmithing shop as well. And RIT was great because we could have all the goodies. Welding machines of all sorts and spinning lathes and whatever I wanted, I could get. And because I'm just curious about all those things, and we were able to procure it and pursue it.
The work that we see a lot of today are of the larger pieces, some of the gates and other things. I mean, I can imagine how it developed from all of these interests and stuff that you've been having, the decorative plus the larger scale.
I think there was a point with the jewelry. I had reached a plateau of sorts, and one of the things I remember that was really a distinctive moment, everything I had made up to about 1979 was metal. And then I got this idea for making some pins that were, I called them momentary ornaments, and they were made out of abrasive paper. I liked the idea, or was curious about the idea, that this tool around that we use all the time, and I began to look at it and I thought, you know, it's really quite lovely stuff. And you have all these different grits, and so there's different hues and different textures. And I made these small pins that were about 2x2, but the pin system was double-sided tape, so therefore momentary ornaments. And I had a show, and we gave everything away, and people would pin them on and wear them for whatever period of time they would stay on. I realize now that was a really important point because it reflected a different kind of curiosity in a way. And so I thought, well, you know, I'm not sure I want to make any jewelry for a while. I want to take a break. I began to work in some wood as well, when began combining some found objects. And I made these things, and I called them constructions, but they look like sculpture. Actually, they look like tables or 18th century decorative object type of thing. And so I made those for about a year or a year and a half, and there came a point where it just was not satisfying anymore. And it didn't satisfy me in terms of the ability of these things to stay together, for one thing. There was something insubstantial about them. And I realized at that point that I had to make things in metal again because I knew that it would be substantial. If I put it there, it was going to stay there. And so I continued to make these pieces that in form really resemble these decorative objects, cups, German wedding cups from the 18th century. And then after I'd made quite a few of those pieces over a number of years, one day I just thought, I think I'll make a gate.
Why not?
Why not? I mean, I've got all this imagery. That's the other major thing. I went from a very abstract sensibility to a representational one, included representational elements such as roses, flowers, of all kinds and cattails. And I just really liked it because it had this poetic sensibility. If you put a rose next to a flat plane that was undulating, there was something unusual about that. And I liked the dynamic that was set up between those two things. There was a kind of a vibration of meaning that didn't exist in the previous work. So I made a gate. Typically, when you make changes in your work, you're at this very beginning state, and you have to work because the answers are in the work. They're always in the work. And if you don't work, you're not going to get any answers. The first stab at it was adequate, but it wasn't a good piece. But in doing that, it really set the stage for the next piece, which was a good piece. Far more comprehensive, far more well thought out. It was thematic. It wasn't just a pile of words thrown into the wind. It was a part of a major exhibition, and I knew that I was on to something, that this was worthy of more attention. And so then that continued. And then, at that point, commissions began to arrive, and which is so perfect because there's nothing more problematic in terms of my temperament than having this collection of these large things around in your own yard. And what I liked about commission work was that generally people would come to me because of they liked what I did. And so therefore, we were already in a very friendly territory. And so these projects would evolve out of mutual discussions and ideas that I would present. It always amazed me that somehow I ended up in this place where that can happen. I remember one time where someone said, you know, we'd like a gate. And I said, well, I've got this new idea, and I would really like to run it by you. And as I began to talk about it, they became so interested. The idea was only words. There was no form. And they said, let's work through this a little more. So I went back and did some drawings and of this particular idea that I was interested in. And it really became something, I think, quite good and interesting, and went back to abstraction. But it was referential. You'd have to know the route. But with a map and a guide, you could trace back to the roots of what this was. So it became fascinating for me, and it became fascinating for the client.
If you just tuned in, you are enjoying the second half of an interview with the Society of North American Goldsmiths Lifetime Achievement Award winner for 2013, Gary Griffin. The program is Ears on Art, produced at the studios of listener-supported public radio KCBX on California's Central Coast. We now rejoin co-host Krissa Hewitt talking with Gary about current projects and the unique atmosphere at Cranbrook Academy of Art.
Is this what you're still most interested in doing, or have you changed scale again?
Well, I am building a dining table. It's a table for my daughter. I gave a cattail dining table to my son and his wife, and of course my daughter promptly...
Hey!
She promptly expressed her wishes. So what this is going to be is a large glass top supported by what will look like a very precarious pile of rocks. And these rocks are all steel fabrications, so they're hollow. We don't really have a timeline as such, and the budget doesn't exist. And so it leaves me very, very open in terms of how I define the rocks, what surfaces I choose for them. And I'm really enjoying not having to have the responsibility of the budget and having the time to give to it whatever I want. It's one of those rare opportunities where you can do so. Then in addition, we have built a house, and all the exterior portals are steel fabrications, and I have one more to do, and literally that's going to be the summer project.
Sounds great. Back to the teaching career. Did you go from Rochester to Cranbrook, or was there something in between?
I taught at the School for American Craftsmen from 1974 to 1984, and then Richard Thomas, who was the head of the metalsmithing department at Cranbrook from, I think, 1948 to 1984, and he was one of the deans of American metalsmithing and wrote one of the early books on the subject. He retired. I knew that I really wanted to have that job. I'd always admired Cranbrook, and I knew that it was a not only a distinguished place, but it was a place that would be challenging to me and that would be a place where I could continue to grow, and both intellectually and otherwise. And I was familiar with many of the faculty that were there at the time, and there were really stellar people, and I thought, I want to join up. My basic strategy is, if you ever think you're going to be called upon to dance, you better know how to dance. So my application, whatever they asked for, I gave even more than that. If I don't get this job, it's not because of my lack of ability to put together an application. I made the final group of people and went out for the interview. They were very interested in me, and I said, well, I have to make another trip. My wife will come with me. I want her to see this. My wife is wonderful, and she's supportive, and even when I was applying, she said, you're going to get this job. You're far too casual about this. She came out, and she said, let's go for it. And the one thing I will never forget, it was the spring, 1984, and the opening of Design America was going to be at the Metropolitan. Roy Slade, who was the director at the time, said, you should come. You should come to the opening. And I thought, I should go to the opening. And I flew to New York, and I remember riding up the Lexington Avenue subway, walking over to the Met. You're standing on Fifth Avenue, you're looking at the front of the Met, and there was a banner that came down over the top, cascaded over the top, and it said, Design in America, the Cranbrook Vision. Unbelievable. Then proceed up the steps, and I thought, oh, I'm going to heaven. It was glorious. I mean, just absolutely glorious.
First of all, item of disclosure here, I am also a Cranbrook graduate, 73-75, with Richard Thomas. I think it would be helpful to give a little description of the nature of that institution, because it is not like anything else that I'm aware of, at least in the States.
It's true. It's a true academy, which is a different model than the university in the United States. The only reason that Cranbrook Academy of Art exists is for art and design. That's it. There's nothing else. Basically, you have this studio-based program, and you have artists in residence. There's no faculty rank. Everyone is an artist in residence that heads a department, and there's 10 departments.
The artist in residence is the sole person in that discipline.
That's okay. Correct. And the artist in residence sets the program, the agenda for their discipline. They select the students. They determine what the program is going to be, if there's going to be classes, studios, whatever is required of that is their assignment. In effect, if you called the program, rather than call it metalsmithing or architecture, and you were to call it the name of the artist in residence, That's what it would be. And that's a very unusual model. The other part of it is that the academy is small. There's about 150 students. And in a two-year period, those students will know one another. And it's very, very common for them to establish lines across these disciplines. And it's interesting to me that a place that has these very particular disciplines is one of the most interdisciplinary places. There was interdisciplinary at Cranbrook right. before there was interdisciplinary. It happens because of the vitality of the institution and the overlap. There are no hierarchies there. The artisan residents have no professorial rank. There's none that have higher standing than the other. It's an equal footing. And so that's felt immediately among the students. And the students move, they cross all the time. And the other thing that's really remarkable about it is because there is no class at any particular time, the students also have access to the other artisan residents. And very often, an artist in residence will recommend that someone make an appointment to see another discipline head. And that can be really, really powerful in people's work. It's a very, very different model than a university structure model.
My experience was certainly very conscious of the other disciplines. And as you say, my friendships crossed those paths. But the excitement was having a key and a 24-hour access to a studio.
Well, precisely.
For 2 years.
That also is a very important part of it, because the artists in residence are truly artists in residence. We live across the street. I love the idea that I walk to work for 22 years. And I walk through a museum on my way. How do you beat that? So in other words, I very often after dinner, I would go over, walk through the studio, maybe not say anything to anybody, but being keenly aware of what people are working on. And then the students generally carry on a little bit different schedule than I do. I do get up very early, but that was the time I loved to go over, and I would always walk through their studios, look at what's on the bench, look at what images they have around on the walls, see what seems to be of interest to them. And from my point of view, the idea that the artist in residence is actually living there and working there is really, really remarkable. And the other part of that is that because of this commission business I had and being an artist in residence, I also made my projects there. And I had certain days that the students knew that I was working on my projects, but I also gave many of them summer jobs and weekend work. It sure beats some of the other employment that they could have had. So in other words, they were working within their skill sets. They were being asked to do things that were refined and had to be precise. And then they were seeing a realized project. And I think that's a remarkable and unusual experience, and very pragmatic in a sense.
You also saw a whole new metalsmithing studio, correct?
Yes.
I mean, where I was in the basement.
Right.
With the steam pipes going.
Yes.
And
oh, yes.
Windows open during the winter so
yes.
that you could maybe, you know, still breathe.
When I first arrived, we were in that studio. But then the discussions began. The new studio's building was built for metalsmithing, ceramics, and fiber. We went through a number of renderings and reviewing architects or interviewing architects. There's a great admiration in the architectural community for the Saarinens, both Eliel and Arrow.
Who designed the school?
Yes.
Well, it's a complex, actually. I mean, there's a boys' school, there's a girls' school. There is a elementary school, there's a science institute.
Center. Exactly. 300 acres, basically. But during this period, these architects from around the world were coming to visit. They wanted to build there. So we got every version of architect, and it was really quite remarkable. Okay, we want to do this, but how are we going to do it? And you have to get your ducks in line prior to actually hiring an architect. The architect that was hired was Rafael Moneo, who's a Spanish architect. The new building was so welcome, and it wouldn't get any better than that. I could set it up pretty much the way I wanted to, and the student studios increased in size, probably 100 square feet per student. And then there's
as opposed to a bench.
Yeah, as opposed to a bench. And then there were rooms for all the machine tools. There were a room for casting, a room for polishing, a room for the silversmithing and the welding, hot forging, that type of thing. There was a classroom, which was fantastic, with walls that we could pin up drawings or show work in, show slides or images in. And then there was a very generous studio for the artists in residence.
Earlier you were talking about when you went to New York, that it was spring. And of course, I have wonderful memories of spring at Cranbrook. Being a Californian, spring became a whole different thing.
I really love being in the place. The environment itself is a dictionary of design. And it takes time. It takes a lot of time to soak it in. And I was still discovering things after 20 years.
Yeah, I don't know how many trips through that little archway that I took before I realized that the far end was narrower than the one that I had entered. So
exactly.
It just played off of straight perspective. It's like, of course.
Right.
Well, no.
Right. There's so many things like that.
Gary, this has been terrific. Is there anything that we haven't touched on?
We've covered everything.
Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
This is Ears on Art, and our guest today has been artist metalsmith Gary Griffin, who is now retired from 32 years of teaching and lives in El Rito, New Mexico. An internet search, last name Griffin, will produce images of his work for you, as well as some more biographical information. Next month, Ears on Art presents year number 14 of our unique December storytelling programs. Stephen and I invite you to participate in this marathon of personal tales this year with the theme, The Gift is in the Details. You write your story, 500 to 800 words, and we record you reading it. We have room for 12 to 15 participants. So, I would love to hear from you by November 24th. I can be reached at C. Hewitt, that's H-E-W-I-T-T, at calpoly.edu. These stories do not have to pertain specifically to the holidays, and they could have happened when you were very young or yesterday. Hope that you will join us. You have been listening to Ears on Art, produced here at the studios of KCBX Public Radio. I am Chrissy Hewitt, and on behalf of co-host Stephen DeLuque, I want to thank you so much for listening.
And that does it for this week's Issues and Ideas. Stay tuned next for On Being with today's guest, Dr. Ira Byock, a leading figure in palliative care and hospice in the United States. This is KCBX HD1 San Luis Obispo, KNBX HD1 San Ardo, and KSBX HD1 Santa Barbara. Stay tuned next for On Being here on KCBX.